How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. DNA Today informs you on what's happening in the genetic world. During my broadcasts, I educate the public on genetic and health topics through event coverage, news stories, book movie reviews, and interviews. Guests include genetic counselors, like today, researchers, patient advocates, and professors in the field of genetics. My guest today is Brian Kirkpatrick, a licensed and certified genetic counselor with more than 11 years of experience. She's a member of the National Society of Genetic Counselors, International Society of Genetic Genealogy, and the National Genealogical Society. She has her own private practice, Watershed DNA, where she offers clients her expertise in medical, genetics, and counseling to provide support and information to those seeking DNA testing for genealogic reasons and health purposes. Brian received her bachelor's in biology and religious studies at Indiana University, followed by a master's in genetic counseling at Northwestern University. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about these topics today.
Definitely. It's kind of not exactly a traditional field of genetic counseling, but being non-traditional is becoming almost more popular than being traditional.
Right. Yeah. It's really a niche between the genetic counseling world and the genetic genealogy world. And there was a request for people to get involved who had knowledge in both areas to work with some people that were having some just needs for extra support and information who were seeking this testing.
And for those that may not remember or just kind of are unsure what genetic counselors are, what's your like quick elevator pitch? When you say you're a genetic counselor, people are looking at you like, what do you do? Something about designer babies and you're trying to dismiss all that. What do you usually say?
A genetic counselor in simplified terms is a person who's trained in both the psychological, social, and medical implications of understanding genetic test results and genetic risk evaluation. So what that means is I help people understand the testing options available and what types of information we can find out when we test DNA, and then how to understand those results and really integrate them into their lives. So I see myself as part counselor and part medical professional, and helping people for their own purposes and their family's reasons to pursue testing if it's right for them.
And really just being that translator of saying, this is really dense knowledge and really dense language, and kind of bringing it down to that layman's terms, or kind of assessing your patient's education level and saying, all right, how can I phrase this so that they can understand this and make that decision on their own?
Right. Genetic counselors are really trained to be communicators, and our goal is to communicate more complex information in terms that everybody can understand at their own level.
And you do this at your own private practice, Watershed DNA. How is this a different experience for the patients compared to seeing a genetic counselor at a hospital or talking one to one on a phone that's in a lab?
Yes. So my practice is a teleconsulting business. So most people I'm speaking with, I speak with them over the phone or via video chat. And because of this, it can really be flexible around the needs of my clients. So I schedule calls when it works for them. Some people take a break during work, and so we talk during work hours. I schedule evening calls and weekend calls. So it's really different from the hospital setting, where typically there's a set appointment at a set time of day, and really more like a medical appointment. This is a little bit more like a consultation. So people come to me with a request for either some type of interpretation or support or guidance in choosing a test, and then using a combination of phone calls or video chats, reports, video summaries. I use whatever method is going to work best with that client to meet their needs. So it's a little bit less structured and more flexible, I would say. When I worked in the clinical setting, I was working in a hospital prenatal center for high-risk pregnancies. And I would show up at my set time and leave at my set time. And my interaction was in person and typically limited to one visit, and then writing a letter to the doctor typically. So it was a different setting. There are benefits to both of them. There are some parts of genetic counseling that in the clinical setting work really well that are a little bit more challenging over the phone. So there are benefits and drawbacks to both settings, but this seems to be what's working, and I tried to modify my communication based on the needs of that individual in front of me.
So how does it differ in terms of in a hospital, typically there will be a medical geneticist that is signing off on DNA tests that are ordered and things like that. So how does that differ being in a private practice? Can you order testing, or is it more that patients are seeking you for that interpretation, or that they're going to pursue it on their own or go to a physician later and get that test ordered?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's a little bit complicated when we're talking about genetic counselors ordering testing, because it's really a state-by-state regulation. In where I live in the state of Virginia, the licensure laws surrounding genetic counselors say that we are allowed to order testing. So it would be possible for me to order testing for some of my clients. At this time, most of the clients I work with are either coming to me with their test already having been ordered, and typically an at-home test that they've ordered on themselves. In other situations, I've helped create a testing plan for somebody where they have not yet had testing, but they tell me about the information they're hoping to seek out, and then I can give them information on whether an at-home test would be best for them, or a clinical test that they would need to have ordered through a doctor's office or by a genetic counselor in their area. So at this point, I haven't ordered a test for clients, but it is something that in the future I would be able to do. And my goal is that for every client, I help them find the test that's best for them. And if it ends up being a test that requires a healthcare provider be involved to do the ordering, and if I am allowed to do that for that particular client and feel equipped to do it, then I would foresee that I could do that in the future.
And one type of DNA testing confirms parentage in situations where a parent is unknown, but it can also find parents in circumstances of adoption or where the biological parents don't end up staying in touch with their children. Can you kind of explain how this actually works in terms of the DNA testing? And we share 99.9% of our DNA, so how is it that that 0.1% can really find those differences and find relatives?
Yeah, this is a really relevant and timely question, I feel, with kind of the expansion of the home DNA testing market and the number of people that are ordering tests on themselves, like 23andMe and Ancestry DNA. And there's kind of two issues at play. So the first question is how does the testing work, and is it accurate, I guess, is the question. And then the second part of that is how are these matching databases getting people in touch with one another. So I'll start with the first one, the question of how the testing is done. And it's a common question that I get even from other genetic counselors. They want to know, is this legitimate testing? Is this for real? And the short answer is yes. So this is legitimate. And it's based on scientific research. And really two main areas of science have provided us with enough information that we're able to test DNA and then make conclusions about relationships between people. So molecular anthropology is an area of science where we're able to study the differences between individuals and look back over time and determine from DNA sequences how groups of people evolved. And the other area is population genetics, where we are studying the differences within populations of people and then also between populations of people. And with the outcomes of this science, we've been able to identify particular DNA markers that are shared with groups of people around the world. And with the ancestry testing, we're using a type of technology called genotyping. So genotyping is a testing process it's different from sequencing. So sequencing is looking at the order of letters in DNA, one right after another. And with sequencing, we can either focus in on one particular gene or one particular area of the genome, or we can test the entire genome and try to figure out the sequence of all of the letters. Genotyping looks at particular markers or just one letter, one particular place spread out through the genome. And with ancestry testing, they're using anywhere between 500 to 700,000 individual markers spread out through the genome. And when we compare between two individuals, when we compare between two individuals, whether their markers are matching in a row, we can figure out how large the shared DNA region is between those two individuals. Or to put that another way, if we're comparing two people's chromosome 1, and we see that a region of their chromosome 1 have identical markers, that tells us they likely have a common recent ancestor. And the longer those regions of matching markers are, and the more of those regions are, the more closely related those individuals are. So these companies are using computerized algorithms to cross-compare all of the people in their databases and to figure out how many markers are these individuals sharing and what does that tell us about how closely related they are. And the types of results that can come out of that are these individuals are first-degree relatives. So we would think maybe they're siblings or parents. One's a parent and one's a child. We can get an idea of whether somebody might be a more distant cousin, so a third to fourth cousin or a second to third cousin, that type of thing.
So looking at these different genetic markers, you're calling them, would these be SNPs or single nucleotide polymorphisms, or is it something that's a little bit bigger and not just a single polymorphism?
No, these are SNPs.
Oh, they are SNPs. Okay.
Yeah, they are SNPs. And, some SNPs have significance for medical reasons and many SNPs do not. So ancestry tests are analyzing SNPs of all different types, and each company really chooses what SNPs it's including or not. So some company may include more health-related SNPs, and another might include more ancestry-related SNPs. And each company that you could test with has its own database that, and they're not sharing information with one another. And they have their own set of markers that they're comparing their consumers' results to.
Now, when it comes to variants, these companies then, I'm thinking if they have their own database and their data sharing is not happening between these companies because obviously they're competitors, some companies must be identifying variants as classifying them differently, I guess is the phrase I'm looking for. So one company may say that this is related to something and another company may say the same variant is related to something else. Is that kind of what happens sometimes?
So we as the consumer would not see that. That might be happening kind of on the back end, but when you're looking at your results on your online results page, you see your match list, which is the list of people that you are matching with who have also tested at that company. You can look at your ethnicity results. So it's typically a pie chart or a map of the world where you're given a rough percentage of how much of your DNA seems to have come from that part of the world. And so we don't see any of the background details about the SNPs themselves. So some of the companies do give you access to your raw data file, and that is a computerized version of your raw data of your SNPs where they vary from the standard set of SNPs. And some people take that raw data and run it through other tools to try to glean information. There are some genealogical focused third-party tools that people have begun to use that can give a more refined estimate of their ethnic background or provide some other information. There are some third-party tools that are attempting to provide health information from the SNPs of ancestry testing. There are some potential benefits, but there are also a lot of concerns because the raw data that comes from ancestry testing hasn't gone through a second level of confirmation testing like a sample at a clinical laboratory would. So the raw data itself is not FDA approved, so to speak. So some people have been able to identify health risks. For clients who come to me, I typically recommend they repeat the testing through a CLIA certified lab. CLIA is one of the regulating bodies that oversees genetic testing and makes sure that the results that come out can be believed and relied upon.
And one of the problems I would imagine with people uploading their own information and reading is if they are not trained in genetics, which most people aren't, that they might misinterpret things on their own if a genetic counselor isn't kind of sitting with them or guiding them and saying, yes, this is relevant information that's been kind of scientifically backed up, versus they could be reading something that maybe is not, and they can't really tell the difference between those.
Right. And I have the belief that people can understand, once they're explained their results, they can understand that. But being able to interpret a complex report, or even to try to interpret their own results when they're trying to process the emotional impact of that result at the same time, it can really be a challenge for a lot of people. I've identified some problems with reports that have come out from some of these health-focused third-party tools, and I've tried to point those out to the people who've created the tools themselves. And then I've also tried to explain to the clients that it's not their fault that they had a different understanding of their results, that we wouldn't expect them to be able to interpret a report given their circumstances at that time. So I have a lot of faith that people can understand their report if they're given support and someone to kind of bounce their interpretation off of.
And another great way of learning information about kind of yourself is through family health history and looking at your own family and saying what health problems have they had, the onset of that. And November is actually National Family Health History Month. So why is it important to not only be looking at genetic tests, but looking at your family and seeing what they have been through in their health history?
That's a great question. And a genetic test is only one part of a full genetics evaluation. And like you alluded to, the family health history itself can contain a lot of information as well. And this is something that genetic counselors do every day in our job. We take family health history and we draw out what's called a pedigree or a family tree, where we're documenting different medical conditions and information through the family. So when we take a family health history, we start with the person who's our patient or our client, and we ask about their parents and their children. We ask about their siblings. We ask about their aunts and uncles, first cousins, and grandparents. And we construct what's called a three-generation pedigree. And then we ask a lot of detailed information if it seems relevant. So if someone reports that their uncle had colon cancer, we're going to ask follow-up questions like, how old was he when his cancer first developed? Did he have a recurrence? That type of information, because not only is the presence or absence of a health condition important, but also when it developed. We also ask about conditions that had early onset, starting from birth with birth defects or childhood onset conditions. We ask about conditions that might have developed in family members younger than what is the typical age for that condition. We ask about conditions that affect multiple people in the same family. We ask about pregnancy history, so recurrent miscarriage or infertility. These could be signs of something in the family that we need to be aware of. And we do ask about ethnicity as well, and whether there's any chance that that relatives in the family could be close relatives to one another and have had children together. these are the types of questions that genetic counselors think of. There are many people have limited access to their health history, whether it's because they were adopted or they don't have contact with a portion of their family tree, or they have a really small family, or individuals in their family passed away at relatively young ages before having a chance to develop any conditions. So genetic counselors understand that it can be really hard for individuals to access their family health history. We try to overcome that by supporting communication within families and trying to find different ways to help individuals reach out to family for health information. A lot of genetic counselors have supported letter writing to family members, maybe more distant family members or estranged family. And there are some growing resources online for people to try to sort out some family health history using online methods. So it's a really big part of the genetic counselor's approach to assessing health risk. And National Family Health History Month happens every November, and it's a big month for genetic counselors to get the word out about the importance of this information.
And with Thanksgiving coming up, it's a really great opportunity for a lot of people that maybe see family members once a year on Thanksgiving to say, can we take a few minutes and talk about what you know about our family's health history? And, you know, especially talking to people that are a little bit older in the family and saying, do you know what your mother had or what your father had, or even grandparents? Because a lot of what you said was really looking at three generations. But if you can, definitely, if you could look back even further, you can get a bigger picture and more information because, you know, as we both said, that family health history is a really good aspect and a really good tool to take knowing all of this genetic information. And some say it's the best genetic test.
Exactly. And it can be awkward at a family gathering. I mean, I have family and the thought of going up to grandma and she's asking me, you know, about my kids and how everything's going. And then I have to, you know, try asking her about her medical history at a time. Maybe she doesn't want to think about it there. I do understand there are some challenges to using a family gathering for asking that type of information. So what I recommend some people consider doing is just getting updated contact information for all of their family. So just asking, you know, Aunt Myrtle, can I get your address, Aunt Myrtle? You know, I want to send you a Christmas card. And then you can always approach that family health history later by putting a little health questionnaire in with the Christmas card and saying, you know, I'm gathering this information for myself or for my children. I'd love anything you'd be willing to share. So there are different ways of approaching family that don't necessarily have to be awkward. You know, you can gather information over email. It seems to be a lot easier than talking about it. And also just asking grandma about, you know, what was it like growing up, and starting with a different conversation first that might lead to conversation about health history. There's a lot of different ways to go about getting that important information. And for me, it became the most important to start gathering when I had children. So once it becomes not just about you, but about your children and future generations, it's you never want to wait too long because you never know who's not going to be at the family table next year.
Definitely. And I want to ask you and kind of end with where you see genetic counseling really going. It's a rapidly expanding field. It's kind of the phrase I'm constantly using because I'm constantly reading new stuff and there's this now new field I'm discovering, the field of genetic counseling. So what changes do you really see in the next 5 to 10 years, and what areas of genetic counseling do you see skyrocketing compared to other areas?
Great question. So I think genetic counselors will always remain in the clinic. I think there's a great value of genetic counselors in person and being physically located in hospitals and clinics around the country and in the world. I also think genetic counselors play a really good role in industry and labs and using those communication skills to help industry and labs grow in a direction that's going to support the consumers and customers. I really hope that in the next 5 to 10 years, there's a growing online presence of genetic counselors. There, I see a role of genetic counselors helping people identify the right DNA test for themselves and to be able to understand the results and get support. And with, you know, a limited number of genetic counselors and a growing number of genetic tests, we're going to have to figure out a way that we can reach everybody where they are and answer those questions. So I hope that the psychosocial training of genetic counselors, so our extra training in the psychological and social impact of genetic testing, I hope that is a growing part of genetic counselors' involvement, and then also growing that online presence that I mentioned just a bit ago.
Definitely. And one way that people can find a genetic counselor is to go to nsgc.org. There you can use the feature Find a Genetic Counselor. It allows you to find a genetic counselor either in your area, and if no one's in your area, by phone, or as you said, that you do in your private practice, Watershed DNA, to have video conferences and all types of things, really utilizing the digital age we have. And definitely check out watersheddna.com. Follow on Twitter at GCBRIANNE. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Kara, for having me.
And listeners can go to dnapodcast.com to look at all kinds of information on there. Anything related to the show is on there. And it's a brand new website, so it's definitely fun to kind of check out. Let me know what you think. Follow on Twitter at DNA Podcast, and any questions about the show in general, what we talked about, anything at all, info@dnapodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and join me next week to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.